Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And I'm your host, Rory Hearn. And I'm delighted today to be joined back on the podcast by two of the, I think along with Michael Taft, the most frequent guests on the podcast, my favorite guests, who are the economist, policy analyst, Dr. Tricia Keelty from St. Vincent de Paul, and Dr. Tom MacDonald from the Nevin Economic Research Institute. Tom and Tricia, thanks so much for coming back on Reboot.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we were just talking before the podcast started. It's a bit like Groundhog Day when it comes to budget time. But what's interesting about budget time and why we kind of have to roll ourselves out again and go engage with it is because people tend to engage a bit more around this time, because it's a little bit, you feel that there's a little bit of what it might look like if we'd some sort of participatory democracy where people had an input into decisions. Around the budget time, there's a little bit of debate about, you know, what decisions are made. Tricia, what's your sense of the budget this year? What do you think are the big things for the St. Vincent de Paul that should be in it and that you feel are getting some discussion, and maybe a couple of things that you think aren't getting covered that should be in it?
Yeah, I suppose this year there's a number of different issues. There's very immediate short-term challenges in terms of energy prices and things like that. And then obviously the longer structural issues around childcare, income adequacy, housing, energy poverty more generally, and energy efficiency in terms of climate action as well. So I suppose just to give context from where we're coming at in terms of this budget, you know, we've had a very difficult 18 months, and it's been a very, very difficult 18 months for people on the lowest incomes. We've seen, you know, an increase in food poverty, energy poverty. We've seen, you know, obviously a massive state response to that as well. Although there wasn't, you know, enough provision in our view for those on the lowest incomes, although there was obviously a lot of important measures. And I think at the start of the pandemic, there was a very strong assertion that there was no going back to the way things were. But now we get a sense that it's back to the old way of doing things a little bit. So from our point of view, you know, going back to normal just isn't acceptable, because normal means one in four children experiencing deprivation, thousands of people experiencing homelessness, living in hidden homelessness, and people unable to access the education system. So I think in terms of this budget, from our point of view, it's really, really important to make inroads into those structural issues so that we're not going back to normal. So from our point of view, we've kind of five key pillars in terms of this budget that we'd like to see focused on. And they are adequate social welfare that meets people's minimum essential needs, access to decent work, a living wage for workers, and supporting parental employment, quality public services that support the well-being of people, society, and the economy, a just transition, and poverty-proofing all economic and social policy decisions, including budgetary decisions. So I think at the moment it still seems to be going down to the wire. And in the last couple of weeks, at least, the issue around energy prices has really taken hold. And, you know, there's been a lot of discussion around what would happen in relation to supporting households with those costs. And we're a little bit concerned that the broader issues around poverty will be not addressed, and we'll just be left in a situation where we're standing still, where maybe there will be an increase in social welfare, which will just maybe mitigate some of those rises in the cost of living, but the real structural issues that trap people in poverty may be sidelined, and I suppose that's our concern at the moment.
Yeah, what is the St. Vincent de Paul seeing at the moment, or have you seen over the past couple of months, in terms of, you know, because obviously you're dealing with people directly and supporting them. How are you seeing people coming out of the pandemic? You know, do you see, like, our deprivation levels, poverty levels in terms of people coming to you? Is it still the same? Is it changing? Is it worsening? Is it improving?
So from kind of June onwards, we started to see, you know, the accumulation of things like the eviction ban being lifted, the disconnection moratorium being lifted, and then all the debt that being accumulated during that time, and then, you know, pressures like back to school time. Again, this is one of the busiest times of year for SVP, and we had a 10% increase in calls for back to school help in August. And now we're starting to see people very, very worried about electricity prices, their ability to keep the lights and the heat on during winter. There's a lot of concern out there. And across the country, we're seeing an increase in calls from people who have maybe rent arrears or they've utility arrears, and they're just generally struggling with the day-to-day expenses that are impossible to meet on inadequate social welfare or minimum wage employment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, thanks for that, Tricia. And I might come back to you just on that question of those structural issues that you're talking about, and, you know, what are those in terms of, and how the budget could tackle them. Tom McDonald from NERI, in terms of your analysis of the economy at the moment and where we're at and our the budget framework, do you think the government has it right in kind of where they're at, or what do you think?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say is, I mean, it's clear that the strategy has been very different from the one that happened after 2008. And I suppose that is kind of one acknowledgement it's important to say. Fiscal policy, monetary policy have been very different. This time they've been expansionary. Last time they were very much contractionary, which elongated and made the recession far worse. Very different crisis this time. In terms of the budget and in terms of the economy, I mean, my own view is that the economy will grow very, very strongly over the next 12 months. I know there's supply chain issues. People are talking about inflation coming back, and that's absolutely true. But in terms of the labour market, I would anticipate a very strong recovery. In that context, it's notable. I know we talk about this being budget season, but look, public spending in 2022 will be about 80 billion. And there's only about 1 billion of new public spending measures that would be announced on budget day. So we're actually kind of whittling away at the edges here. We're not, but budget 2022 isn't going to be about transformative change in any way. So we're going to continue to have on. We're going to continue to be very, very low spenders on education per pupil, on childcare. We're still going to be years off fixing the housing crisis, and we're going to throw $500 million at tax cuts by increasing the threshold to get into the marginal rate, something that won't benefit those famous frontline retail workers by a single penny on average. So there's a lot to quibble with in terms of improvements to budgetary policy here. So, I mean, broadly, I suppose the optimistic slant is we're not looking at a half decade long recovery like we had last time, but more negatively, we would appear like we are going back to normal. And there is no desire for a transformative change in the economy.
And just on that tax cuts, what you're saying, half a billion essentially in tax cuts. And of course, the important point to that is that's not just 1 year, that's every year then into the future, you're removing that revenue as a potential investment. Is that the extent of it, or is there more? Do you think?
Well, the way it's baked into the public finances after 2025 is there's going to be $500 million of new tax cuts. And so obviously over a 4 year period, that's cumulatively $2 billion rather. And obviously that's money then that's not being spent on childcare or things that would actually have a very positive influence on gender equality, labor force participation, and so forth. So our view, my view, is that this is a mistake, that this is a regressive measure and doesn't deal fundamentally with any of the cost of living issues, particularly for lower income households, and is therefore a mistake economically and socially.
And in terms of then, because it's, I suppose the important point as well is it's not just tax cuts, it's the not making decisions to increase sources of taxation. And obviously the big one, you know, being the question of corporate tax, which maybe you could comment on and where that's at. And then is there other areas you think we could raise revenue in terms of to be able to invest in health and childcare and housing and poverty and...
Absolutely. I'd be delighted to. I suppose the first thing to say regarding corporation taxes, that we're likely to lose somewhere between 2 and potentially up to 4 or 5 billion annually due to the changes that are coming out of the OECD process, which we will have a greater understanding of where that's going by the end of October. Certainly, Congress will hopefully have made their decisions, and the decisions will have been made by the G20 as well. But if Ireland were to increase its corporation tax rate, it wouldn't necessarily lead to an increase in government receipts in Ireland. Now, obviously, if there's a global effective tax rate of 15%, then Ireland effectively refusing to go to 15% would mean that it's just losing that money, because it would go to it would ultimately go to the home country anyway. But Ireland increasing its corporation tax rate is unlikely to lead to significant revenue increases in Ireland. However, that's not necessarily the point from a tax justice point of view. The point is that low tax regimes like Ireland are essentially able to induce multinationals to allocate their profits to Ireland, and that is harming other countries by hitting their tax revenues, which ultimately hits their public services, hits their social welfare payments and so forth. So if you wanted to actually increase revenue in Ireland, how would you do that? Well, the big elephant in the room in Ireland is actually PRSI. We have a very, very weak PRSI, our social insurance system, compared to other Western European countries in particular. So employer PRSI and self-employed PRSI in particular both need to go up to the tune of billions per year. Then if you're looking at how do you reconcile equality versus economic growth, then you're looking at things like wealth taxes, inheritance taxes, even property taxes, and very importantly, getting rid of tax reliefs, which tend to benefit higher income households to a much greater extent than lower income households. A good tax system would have precisely zero tax reliefs. We spend effectively in a non-transparent way somewhere between 5 and 10 billion every year on these tax reliefs, depending on how you count different things as tax release. That's an enormous amount of money and could go a long way to fixing all of the economic and social infrastructure issues that we have in this country.
So it's a part of the big, when we see the debate on the taxation rate, and we'll see this and the need to bring in this, you know, the tax cut that Leo Varadkar and Pascal Donoghue would justify. They never talk about the actual effective tax rate, which you always have made this point that what is the actual tax rate, and those at the top benefit the most from that because they get all these various tax reliefs via their accountants and that.
Absolutely. So pension tax breaks, for example, 80% of the benefit goes to the top 20% of earners. Wouldn't it be better to have simply a higher basic pension for everybody? So just from a public policy point of view, just doesn't make sense if the goal is to reduce pension or poverty. And there's lots of other examples. Inheritance tax, for example, there's 90% reliefs for business and agriculture assets. So you can inherit up to 3 million of business assets without paying a single penny. On the other hand, if you're again a nurse working overtime, you could be paying almost half your income. But if you're sitting at home and inheriting 3 million, you get to do so for free. So there's clear inequities within the tax system that, you know, that could very, very easily be resolved and would have zero negative impact upon economic growth or anything like that. It would be very, very beneficial in terms of wealth equality, income equality, and so forth. And there's a lot of things that actually wouldn't cost a lot of money. So having childcare as a universal basic service would cost less than 1% of GNI. So two years of these income tax cuts, just increasing the marginal tax rate or the threshold at which you enter it, would be enough money to solve the childcare problem forever once it's baked in. So these are very short-sighted policies that just make no sense to an economist, but only make sense if you're looking at policies that are designed to benefit particular groups of people that vote in particular ways.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, that question of, you know, why are these policies being pursued? When, as you say, like that's a very stark figure and contrast that the tax cuts that are going to be given this year could actually provide a universal childcare system. Thanks, Tom. Tricia Keelty from St. Vincent de Paul. Just a question on the structural. What do you see are those structural poverty issues that you talked about, and what do you think the budget could do to address them?
Yeah, so Tom's already touched on some of them in terms of one of the most important one is in terms of access to childcare and providing access to childcare. Because currently the European Commission has published the EU Child Guarantee, which requires member states to provide equal and effective access for children in disadvantaged circumstances to free early years care and education, free school and education, and also free nutrition and healthy nutrition, and also adequate housing. So that's a really, really important lever that the government should be looking to ensure that we're addressing poverty and providing access to good quality services for children and families so that they can move out of poverty for good. I suppose from going back to the issue of the tax cuts and the half a billion, what could that actually provide? Tom's already talked about childcare, but what it could deliver actually would be free primary and secondary education. Genuinely free primary and secondary education is estimated to cost in the region of 230 million extra a year. So that would be a massive change. It would lift a huge amount of pressure on families that would much prefer that than a tax cut. We saw the Citizens Assembly said, you know, we would much prefer investment in public services rather than tax cuts. So as well as lifting pressure on parents, it's also giving children the opportunity to participate in education on the same footing as their peers. So we know even, you know, if children are going to school, they feel different, they don't have what they need to learn. That has a big impact on their experiences at school, and then, you know, leads to issues like early school leaving. So if you can give children the best start in life, that has huge knock-on impacts throughout their life and their life opportunities, and it brings much greater savings to the state in the long run. So access to good quality early years and access to education are really key. The second pillar from our point of view is adequate income, because we obviously need investment in good quality services so that people aren't paying out of pocket for things that are taken for granted in other European countries. But at the same time, we need a social protection system that provides people with a minimum that is required to participate in society, but also meets their minimum physical, psychological and social needs. So we're back now to the stage of, will we put a fiver here or a fiver there? And what we've been saying for a very, very long time is that we need to look at a proper mechanism to take the political football out of social welfare increases every year and have a system that is benchmarked against the cost of what is required to meet that minimum standard of living, so that we're not, you know, people have certainty then around in terms of what their income will be, and people aren't forced to cut back on basics to make ends meet. Because I think we really, really saw during the pandemic, by introducing that higher rate of pandemic unemployment payment, was a recognition of the inadequacy of our existing social welfare supports. Why is it acceptable for someone who is on disability payment or a lone parent to have to survive on 203 euro a week? It's simply just not enough, and we need to ensure that our social protection system is grounded in evidence on what people actually need to survive. So that's our kind of main message. And I suppose to reach that threshold would require action over a number of budgets. So this year we're saying that it would be a 9.80 euro increase on working age payments, with a 10 euro increase for children over 12 and a 2.10 euro increase for children under 12. So that would allow us to reach an adequate level by 2025. So that's kind of what we would see as being the most important. And then obviously tackling issues around transport, energy, and then obviously housing as well are the key issues that lock people into poverty. We see particularly the difficulties people in rural areas face when they're on a very, very low income, because they don't have access to public transport, and they tend to be living in more poorly insulated homes, and also be relying on things like oil, which is more expensive as well. So if we had a very wide-ranging retrofit program, particularly of social housing. And that's one of the simplest things the state can do to address energy poverty by investing in a deep retrofit program of our social housing. Last year, I think there was $65 million allocated towards the retrofit of social housing, which really just is only touching the surface. It would give maybe in the region of 100-150 retrofits, which is really not enough given the number of social housings which have very, very low BRRRR ratings and need to be upgraded. So from an energy poverty point of view, that's really, really important. And then obviously we have to deal with the short-term pressures now families are faced with given rising energy prices. So we've said that the fuel allowance needs to be increased, so extending it from 28 weeks out to 32 weeks, but we also need to expand eligibility for it because it's very, very means tested and many people who are struggling with energy poverty don't qualify. So by expanding it to those in receipt of the working family payment and also removing the wait period for job seekers allowance would ensure that those households had extra security during this time. But I suppose in the interim, we also need to be looking at other measures. So, for example, in other European countries, they have what is called a social tariff. So that is a discounted tariff for people who are on low incomes. So that could be seen as an interim measure while we move to renewables and eventually the cost of energy will decrease, that there is this extra security there for people in terms of the unit costs that people are being forced to pay as well.
Yeah, no, I think, again, you know, there's a lot, so much there that, you know, that could be drawn. And I think definitely it really strikes me how, you know, quietly this change back from the PUP payment, which was, as you say, considered, you know, essentially, you know, somewhat adequate welfare support, back to the pre-pandemic payments, which those on existing welfare, as you say, those in are expected to live on, that seems to have just kind of gone back. Do you see any sort of change within the state, the policy system, as accepting that actually the PU payment level is where we should be heading towards?
So there is commitments in the roadmap for social exclusion to look at a benchmarking approach to pensions and then also working age pensions. So I think in the last number of budgets, there has been recognition of the need to attach it to some sort of benchmark. And they have been referencing the Vincentian Partnership for Social Justice work on this. But I think the overall drive to do that is very much continually comes down to this idea of deserving and undeserving a lot of the time. Yeah. So I think the move now is to have pay-related social insurance where your earnings would be linked to, sorry, your payment would be linked to your previous earnings. But there's been very, very little discussion about what those who are only reliant on social assistance would be, who can't access the labour market for whether it's caring reasons or if they have a disability. That hasn't really featured in the discussion in terms of a new social protection system, which we're a little bit concerned about. So there's a danger now that those will be left behind and still there'll be no metric then to measure the adequacy of those payments as well.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. Just on the we know obviously rents are going to have increased again. Have you any proposal around that, rents or the housing assistance payment?
So in our view, there's two main things that need to happen. We would like to see a rent arrears fund established to prevent homelessness. As we mentioned, that there is limited protection there through the RTB, which will eventually expire. But there's many people who have built up arrears and they're at risk of becoming homeless. So we need to have a very, very strong focus on prevention. In relation to the housing assistance payments, you know, the top ups that people are forced to pay. Yeah. Really, really, really push people into financial distress. You know,
and you would see that quite a bit, wouldn't
yeah,
you?
Very, very frequently. It's a huge issue. So we would like to see the limits increased as an interim measure until we see more obviously social housing come on stream, just to protect people so they're not cutting back on essentials and putting themselves at risk of homelessness because they can't afford the top up.
It would seem logical, again, to me that the government would put an actual rent freeze in place rather than even linking to inflation, because As rents increase, the government's own spending on the housing assistance payment into the private rental sector has to increase as well. So I just don't like, I don't get why they're, you know, because they're, the HAP limits then are, you know, are constantly chasing these rising rents. Would you be supportive of a rent freeze?
Yeah, I think that's something that has to be looked at. And I know they're saying there's constitutional barriers to that, but then there's also constitutional experts who are saying that that's not the case and we should be looking at it, should be proportionate. And I think at this stage, when you have such dramatic rent increases across the country and you see such breaches in already the rent pressure zone, that something more significant needs to happen in that regard, because the current trajectory just isn't sustainable. And as you said, a huge amount of state funds goes towards HAP. And while it's a really important interim support for people, it's just not the long-term solution that we need. And we need to be looking at rent certainty for renters as well as more social and affordable housing.
Yeah, great, Tricia. Thanks, absolutely. And I think as well, the point there is that let the landlords or whoever take the government to court and challenge constitutionally a rent freeze. And while you're doing that, just hold a referendum to put the right to housing in the constitution. Then we'll sort it out very quick. Tom, in terms of just that, on that on housing, two things get your reaction to. First, what's your sense of how much could, obviously we saw the ESRI report and we covered it in the podcast here recently with Kieran McQuinn from the ESRI, the recommendation to double capital expenditure on housing. They actually said that there was a potential 4 to 7 billion that could be raised additionally from borrowing to invest. Mm-hmm. What do you think is there in terms of the capacity? How much could we increase or should we increase our capital expenditure on the provision of public affordable housing, do you think?
Well, I'll get to that in just a second, but just to pick up on that last point, Rory, I mean, we about having effectively a maximum price for a service, i.e. rent in this case, but we have minimum prices already, which are legislated for national minimum wage, minimum price on alcohol and things like that. I don't see necessarily how there's a difference here. On the issue of capital spending on housing, I mean, from a fiscal point of view, there really aren't constraints. I mean, it's how long is a piece of string? How much are you willing to tax? So it's not an issue. We have a range from countries going anywhere from 20% to 50%. Ireland is at the lower end of the spectrum. So there's no fiscal policy.
Which do you mean to explain that?
In terms of public spending as a percentage of output, it can range from 20% in the United States to 50% in Denmark. So there is no constraint on public spending.
And we're in the region of?
We tend to be towards the lower end, particularly compared to other Western European countries. So in terms of how big can public spending go, your $4 to $7 billion is, if anything, an underestimate. I mean, you could spend far, far more than that on housing. However, you would ultimately be linking it to the amount of revenue that you as a state are bringing in. However, again, a second caveat on that is there's no reason that you couldn't set up a semi-state to provide housing over the economic cycle, which would be able to scale back its spending as if house building were for some reason to start overheating again, like it did in the noughties, and at the same time to countercyclically respond as you would now to build extra houses. Of course, there's always going to be a lag with these things, and that's very, very difficult in terms of responding to sharp recessions, for example. There's always going to be a 2 to 3 year lag. And unfortunately, when you talk about building up capacity, that building up of capacity, given that we've wasted almost a decade, will take a couple of years, if not longer. And one of the big issues is the lack of labor supply. There's a labor supply issue for construction workers almost everywhere now. There have been years of people not going into that sector because it was seen as too volatile, particularly after the 2008 crash. So unfortunately, Ireland has lost a lot of its capacity to upscale very, very quickly. That doesn't mean that we can't get back that capacity. It just means that there will be a lag of a couple of years as people gain those skills. But that's like a once off effect. Once we have achieved that, there is no reason in practice or in theory why we wouldn't be able to very, very quickly get up to 40,000 plus houses per year. There really isn't. There aren't financing issues in the sense that the state itself can intervene, and the state does not have any financing issues. There's only financing issues if you are beholden to the idea that the private sector have to be the ones that are, you know, going out themselves, providing the financing, borrowing on the markets and so forth. If the state does that and subcontracts, then it doesn't have to be an issue. So there is a practical resource constraint in terms of labor supply and some other issues.
What do you think is the quickest way to build up that capacity?
The quickest way to build up that capacity is that we have to have people come through apprenticeships and training with those skills as quickly as possible within Ireland. The alternative is that we outsource these people from other countries, not necessarily even within the European Union, and we have to make it attractive for them to come here, because we simply don't have enough construction workers at the moment. And remember,
do you think that as you say, a semi-state or a public home building agency would be the obvious thing to do that would give proper lifetime contracts? And
I completely agree. And that type of model could also work for retrofitting. For example, we want people over the next 20 years to be gaining these skills. These are enormous amounts of work and enormous amounts of money that will be funneling through the system over the next 10, 20 years and beyond indeed. So these can be lifelong careers for people. Not just people in their teens and 20s now, but people that might want to transition to a different type of job. We've seen a lot of people are very unhappy in their work over the last 18 months. They've realized that they do want to change. And there could be very, very stable opportunities out there, particularly if the state was to seriously grapple with the issue and provide. It could be two different semi-states, one for retrofitting, one for and a just transition, and one for house building. There's no reason in economics why we cannot do that. And so to me, at this stage, it almost seems kind of obtuse that we're not going down that route.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point. Just one last one for you, Tom. The taxation side of housing, in terms of this budget, it would have been ideal had we been introducing a vacant property tax in this budget. And also, I think, removing the real estate investment tax break. What's your views on those?
Oh yeah, no, I'm very, very hostile to the idea that tax breaks are a way to run an economy. There's very, very few areas where tax breaks make economic sense. Research and development might be one, for example, because there's always going to be an underprovision by the market. But there's no reason in principle why that needs to be the case with housing. Again, going down the model of having a state semi-state that is providing good quality cost rental housing and indeed social housing over a medium to long term is, to my mind, a much better way to go. And I mean so you don't stop the private market from entering if it makes sense for them to do so. But there's no need to provide these tax breaks, which by and large have enormous deadweight loss and tend to be very, very, very aggressive.
They're still holding on to that real estate investment trust tax break. They're here.
They are here, absolutely, and they're not just going to walk away. And there's this idea that you give tax certainty, and that if you're constantly changing your taxes or removing a relief when somebody comes in, that it might disincentivize people in the future from entering the market. Not necessarily even in the housing area, but it could be other areas as well. Like one of the reasons why I keep focusing on certainty about corporation tax is that it's this deal, it's this guarantee that we will give to future FDI that we want to kind of bring into the country. That's the theory behind it. Whether it actually makes sense in practice, I'll leave up to you. But also, we keep trying tax breaks at people buying first-time homes and stuff like that. All that does is push up house prices. So you don't resolve a housing crisis, which is a lack of supply, by shoveling coals onto the fire that, you know, heat up demand. You actually just provide supply. it's not actually that complicated at a kind of a theoretical level. Now, the practicalities of doing that are very, very complicated, and it does take a number of years. And even if you came out with the best plan in the world in October, you know, it would still be a few years before you really saw a success in terms of the housing market. Now, don't get me wrong, we will produce more than 20,000 houses next year, and it will continue to improve over the next 3 to 5 years, unless there's another surprising shock. And obviously, we're having issues with real estate in China at the moment, and who knows how far that will blow. But ultimately, it is something that we're going to have to acknowledge is it's going to take a number of years. But it's not clear to me that we even have the right policies in place now to resolve the crisis. And because of that, it will take longer than it otherwise would have to fix, which means higher rents, higher house prices, higher cost of living, which is bad for the economy, which is bad for all of our cities. And obviously that makes us less attractive to FDI. So it's actually a false economy in the long run. Again, ultimately, the only people that really benefit from this are landlords.
Yeah, and real estate investment trusts and investment funds and wealth.
And they're landlords too.
They are, absolutely, yeah, the new corporate landlords. Tricia, thanks, Tom, for that. Tricia, last word to you. In terms of the overall, I suppose, debate on the budget, what's your sense of it? Is poverty, inequality, social justice part of it this year more than previous years? Or are we still, do you think, caught in that very conservative economics, mainstream free market economics discussion?
I don't think it's going to be a budget that's going to deliver for the people that we're assisting. I'd like to be hopeful and optimistic, and you know, there's still time, but yeah. I think it's just going to be measures that will mitigate some of the cost of living issues that people are facing, and life will continue, or maybe slightly worse, unfortunately, for people that we're supporting, because people are just struggling day to day and week to week. But I think hopefully there will be something significant in relation to child poverty. I hope will feature. I'm not sure it will, but I think it's something that the government need to take seriously. We haven't got our poverty figures. The CSO haven't released them yet. And we really will, I think we're going to see a very dramatic increase in deprivation for households, unfortunately, unless there's significant intervention in this, because it really, from our point of view, the fact that so many children live in poverty is a shame for us all, and it really, really needs to be taken seriously. And it was something actually the Ombudsman for Children actually has put forward this as a core issue as we move post-COVID, that children and families need to be seen as a priority, which they weren't during COVID, unfortunately. And we've seen significant impacts on children in terms of their mental health and their educational well-being as well. So from that point of view, you know, it's really critical that it's seen as a priority, and we'll just have to see what comes out next Tuesday.
Great. Thanks, Tom, yeah.
And Rory, just last point as well, remember inflation in August was 3%. And although there is a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen to inflation over the next year, is it one-stop shocks and so on, there is now a significant minority of economists that think inflation could be embedded at higher rates in 2022 and beyond. And for that reason, I think it's incumbent upon government to, at least on a one-off basis in Budget 22, ensure that all social welfare increases increased by at least 4%, just to ensure that real living standards don't fall for low income households. Now that would cost what, somewhere in the region of $750 million, something like that. I think if you're looking at a welfare budget of around $20 billion, you could be talking about $750-800 million. I think it would make much more sense to have that as a priority rather than, you know, $500 million of tax cuts for middle and upper middle class households.
Yeah, no, it's a very important point. Tom McDonald from NERI and Tricia Keelty from Civitas Paul, thank you so much for coming back on Reboot and having our budget discussion, definitely a difficult one. And I think that the points that you're making around, again, what you've done every time you've come on, you've shown what's possible, what could be done. I suppose a little bit of hope for me is that I think the general public's sense is they do want investment rather than tax breaks. And I think the politics and government are behind that because they're looking at certain groups that they're making policy for. But I think that's what is going to change over time. It has to. But those areas that you've talked about, child poverty, welfare, in terms of the ability to borrow and invest, childcare, these are key areas that need a focus. Thank you so much for coming on today on Reboot, Tom and Tricia.
Thanks, Rory.
Thank you.
And a reminder to our listeners, thank you very much to those who are patrons, who are supporters of Reboot Republic. We are a podcast that relies completely on you to cover the cost of production. We have no sponsorship, no advertising. We're independent media. We know that you value the podcast. And so if you can become a supporter of Reboot Republic, go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and sign up for whatever you can each month, the price of a cup of coffee or whatever you can. And as always, you can listen back to all these episodes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, all the issues. We've had some really interesting podcasts recently with, as I mentioned earlier, Kieran McQuinn from the ESRI. We've also had Michael Taft on discussing economics of the budget as well. And we also had a really good one with Mel Reynolds on housing and the housing crisis. So you can listen back to those, Reboot Republic. Check us out on Twitter at Reboot Republic. And also we're hanging around Instagram somewhere as well, and probably Facebook if Tony's there, but I don't think he is. But anyway, listen, we'll talk to you all soon. Thank you very much for listening.